Hello, this is Robert Rickover at Body Learning, and today my guest is Martin Goldman, who is an Alexander Technique teacher and a dentist. Martin has been a dentist for over 30 years. He's recently trained to become a teacher of the Alexander Technique. He lives in Berkeley, California, and today we're going to talk about TMJ issues and how the Alexander Technique can perhaps provide some new perspectives on that whole issue. Martin, welcome to the program.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Robert.
Now, I know before we began the interview, you mentioned that you had been a dentist for some 30 years. And at some point, I assume you encountered the Alexander Technique and at some later point decided to train to become a teacher. And how did that come about?
Well, actually, I came to Alexander Technique teaching training kind of indirectly. I had a practice where I had a specialty practice of endodontics, and people would be sent to me for differential diagnosis by other dentists and by physicians, and these people would have the request that I rule out the possibility that pain of the pulp, which is the blood vessels and nerves inside the teeth, might be causing either chronic or acute pain that these patients were suffering. And I could do that very efficiently. If it was indeed the pain coming from inside the tooth, I could treat that effectively. And if it wasn't, most times the patients would be quite grateful not to have root canal treatment and go off happily, but I would be left wondering, what is this pain from? Although I knew it wasn't from inside the tooth, they were still suffering, and I wasn't quite sure. And after I've been in my Alexander training, I realized that a good portion of these people were suffering from unnecessary, harmful muscular holdings of the head, neck, and back. And I realize now in retrospect that if I would have just been keen enough to observe these people as they walked to the chair and sat down in the chair, that I might have been able to help them with their pain. My belief and my understanding of pain of the head, neck, and back is that, as Janet Travell, who was actually Kennedy's personal physician, said, that pain of the head and neck and back is 90% muscular holding patterns, and I believe that to be an understatement.
Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you would say that before you had any Alexander training, you sent the people away feeling a little uneasy about that because you weren't able to help them. But it is also true that a lot of dentists do work with TMJ, and I'm assuming that you're having studied the Alexander Technique, that maybe your approach to TMJ might be different than most dentists. Would that be fair to say?
I think there's a growing trend among dentists to recognize that the movements of the lower jaw, or what is called the mandible, is not a joint-centric, or it's not something that happens in a bone-to-bone relationship or a hinge-type movement, but rather these movements are controlled by muscles. I think it's important for someone who wants to perhaps be able to undertake a way to relieve their own pain, to become their own therapist, so to speak, recognize the suspensory nature of the lower jaw. I think that's a fact that can only work to people's benefit who are suffering from what is called TMJ. First of all, is kind of a catch-all phrase. It's also called craniomandibular disorders or craniofacial pain disorders, or more accurately, temporomandibular dysfunction. TMD is what the pain caused from muscular holdings is more accurately referred to. The temporomandibular joint can be affected by clenching or unnecessary holding of the jaw, and there can actually be pathology in the joint, but I think the answer lies in being able to release these unnecessary muscular holdings. The suffering of people afflicted with TMD are legion. That some of the symptoms of TMD are crippling headaches, destruction of the dentition, disturbed sleep patterns, pain up and down the shoulder girdle and into the arm. There's just a widespread variety of symptoms that people who are suffering from this unnecessary holding exhibit. And a lot of times they'll seek medical treatment first because they don't really think that these far-flung symptoms have anything to do with the way that they're holding their lower jaw. And typically physicians will prescribe either muscle relaxants or analgesics, potent narcotics, and all of these have a price to pay. And I think that for a good portion of people, that relief can come in an organic, sustainable way without punishing the rest of your body. And indeed, by freeing your jaw and freeing your neck, there can be benefits throughout your body.
So,
in terms of balance, coordination.
Right. Would it be your suggestion then that someone who is suffering from TMJ, that maybe the very first thing they do is gather some accurate information about how the jaw functions, how their jaw functions?
I think so. I think in order to relieve a problem, you first have to become aware of the problem, and to become aware of temporomandibular dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the reason it's called temporomandibular is there's a large bone on the side of the head called the temporal bone, and there's a series of muscles that control the lower jaw or the mandible. So that's where temporomandibular comes in. If you can picture that, almost like the strings of a marionette are the muscles, and the jaw is the marionette being mm-hmm. controlled by these muscles. And if you can, let's start with just some basic anatomy here where people can locate where their temporomandibular joint is.
Yes, I think that would be excellent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm going to suggest people putting their little fingers in their ears with their palms facing forward, but I'm a little bit hesitant to do that because then they won't hear the rest of the instructions. So maybe they ought to listen to what I suggest they do first of all, and then go ahead and place their little fingers. So if you put your little fingers, palm facing forward, into your ear opening, mm-hmm. and then move your jaw from side to side, and what you feel moving there is the head, what's called the head of the condyle. You can feel that moving around as you move from side to side. Okay, so that is the bottom half of the temporomandibular joint. And this is where the jaw articulates with the skull at this point. If you go up just a little bit from where you feel that condyle moving around, that's skull, immovable bone. A lot of people have the idea that when the jaw opens, that there's a hinge axis there. If you can think of like a box with a hinge on one side, and you turn the box over, and as the lid swings open, that That's the way the lower jaw opens. And in fact, that isn't the case. And having that body image can lead to a lot of problems. It constricts your movement, and it also constricts your neck and puts pressure on your larynx. It actually is uncomfortable, even though you can make that movement, that hinge axis movement. It's uncomfortable to do that. Another misconception.
I think it might be good just to elaborate on that a little bit. A hinge joint, as you say, might be opening and closing a box or opening and closing a door, which actually is on a hinge. It's a very simple movement, and it may look as though that's what your jaw does, but as you say, it's somewhat more complicated than that. And I think it's probably fair to say that there's a sliding forward.
Yes,
of that condyle,
yeah, exactly right.
As the mouth opens, so that as you open your mouth, your jaw not only lowers in space, let's say, but also has a little tendency to release. I'm not sure how to describe that direction.
Forward and down, and you can
forward and down. Yeah, that would
by putting your fingers back in your ears and then closing your teeth together, you can feel the head of your lower jaw, the head of the condyle, closing the temporal mandibular space. You can actually feel that ball on the top of your lower jaw moving up and constricting your joint space.
Mm-hmm.
Try that. Just put your little fingers in your ear again and close your teeth together, and you can feel that space closing down.
Mm-hmm.
And then by way of contrast, when you put your fingers back in your ear, just open your lower jaw, and you can immediately can't feel that head of the condyle anymore. It's immediately drops forward and down where you can't palpate it anymore. So that lets you know that there's an arc going on. And what we found through computer tracking of the lower jaw, the movements of the lower jaw, is that if you think of a center of rotation, like the jaw, if the point of the chin is the outer portion of a circle, and it's going to describe an arc, where the center of that circle would be, if you would project out the axis of rotation, is actually if you go up under your ears and come down about a half an inch. If you think of that as the center of rotation, it just frees up your lower jaw movement magnificently. It's hard to talk about this. It would be easy to have an Alexander teacher describe that and be able to have you locate that. But if you go up to right underneath your earlobes, come down about half an inch, and then think of that as where the center of the circle that would be scribed, the arc that would be scribed by the point of your chin as you open.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it a muscular movement. It frees up your jaw. It takes it away from that bone-to-bone constricted feeling that we were feeling previously. If our listeners take nothing away from this discussion other than the fact that movement of the lower jaw is guided by muscles rather than by bones and joints, I think it can have nothing but benefit for them.
And I'm going to assume, I haven't tried that experiment with going a bit below the lobe and then assuming that's the center of the move of the arc described by the end of your jaw as you open and close your mouth. But I'm assuming that is actually a more accurate description of what happens than, for example, the joint being a hinge joint, which we've said it's not. And I'd like to just elaborate on that a little bit, because it applies to other aspects of anyone's functioning. We're mainly talking about TMJ here, but there does seem to be a kind of a law of human movement that when your idea of how something is operating actually matches the physical reality of your body, the movement's going to be a lot smoother than if your concept of what's going on differs from the reality. And so it sounds a little to me like what you're saying is find out what that reality is and use that as your guide to movement.
Exactly, exactly. How we think about movement really influences the outcome of movement. That's a demonstrable fact. I'll give you a kind of another guided experiment that mm-hmm. might illustrate that point for us. Mm-hmm. What I'd like for our listeners to do is close their teeth together and give just a little bit of a clench, and then check in with your breath. Just see how that affects your breathing. Mm-hmm. Okay, and now by way of comparison, I'm going to have you, I'll explain this later, but if you just say the word Boston slowly and then check in with your breath.
Mm-hmm. And what does saying that word do? It introduces movement in the system, for sure.
What saying the word Boston does is it gives you a rough approximation, but is within the zone of where would be what's called the physiologic rest position of the mandible. Ah. Now, this is a repeatable and definable position that's unique for each individual. Dentists, by way of special measuring, I don't want to get too technical, but dentists can identify within a tenth of a millimeter where this physiologic resting position is. And what the physiologic rest position, just briefly, a brief definition of that, is when all the muscles that open and close your lower jaw are in balance and are at resting length, where they're at their most ready for movement and most balanced equilibrium. It's a state where there's the least amount of electrical activity going in on those muscles to maintain tonus. A lot of times I hear people say, to if they notice someone clenching, to say, well, let your jaw go. But it's not to let your jaw go to the place where it's most at ease, is not to gape open, you know, that slack jaw yokel look. That's not what we're after. We're looking at the balance, at the neutral position between opening and closing, and that's the physiologic rest position. When you're in the physiologic rest position, your lips can come lightly together, barring any kind of developmental disorder or abnormality that way. But your lips will be lightly together, and your teeth will be apart. Anytime your teeth are touching during the course of the day, there's a good chance that either that's a dysfunctional or a actual pathologic position for you. You're going to do some harm to yourself if your teeth are touching together needlessly during the day. Sometimes your teeth can touch lightly when you swallow, and there's just the occasional glancing blow when you're chewing. Most times your teeth don't come together when you're chewing. So if someone that's suffering from muscular tension will just monitor the space between their teeth and give themselves permission to allow their lower jaw to give in to gravity, to sense the gravitational pull on their lower jaw. It's actually a heavy piece of bone, but don't give in a millimeter more than is necessary. But that's one thing that's nice about the temporal mandibular joint, is that most joints in the body, gravity will tend unless you are allowing some uprighting reflexes to occur, your joints will settle. That's why you're shorter at the end of a day than you are when you wake up in the morning. But the temporomandibular joint is the only joint in the body where gravity is actually your friend. It's actually a relief to know that if you can recognize the gravitational pull on your lower jaw, that you don't need to hold it up. You don't have to needlessly brace your lower jaw or have it overclosed. If you can recognize the physiologic rest position, then your overall sense of well-being will improve.
Mm-hmm.
Did that make sense?
Yes.
That was a lot of talking.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I want to just come back briefly to someone who's listening to this. And you've given some very valuable suggestions for working on your own on this issue. And I think another thing that someone who's really interested in pursuing this would probably do well to get a very, very basic anatomy book or some sketches of how the jaw moves relative to the head, so they can help them to visualize a little bit what's going on. It doesn't have to be a medical school anatomy book. It could be just a basic, very basic description. And I would bet, and I'm not sure about this, but I would bet on YouTube or somewhere, there are probably some little movies that'll actually show that.
Exactly.
And if you look at that and take a look.
When they're looking at this anatomy book, I would like, there's a set of muscles that open the jaw, and if you compare them to the muscles that close the jaw, you'll see that there's quite a disparity in size. The muscles that open the jaw don't need to be as robust because gravity helps to open the jaw. That's an important idea to take away from looking at an anatomy book. Mm-hmm. And
I would think, I'm just going to throw this out, but just listening to what you've just said, that maybe an interesting experiment for somebody is to see how little work they can get away with to open their mouth.
That's a wonderful idea. Yes, and if you pick a certain time of the day to maybe do this activity, I find that even with all my thinking and work with this, we're all human and we'll all react to stimuli in a preconceived habitual way often. And if I'm driving in traffic, a lot of times I'll catch myself and say, oh my goodness, why am I holding my jaw like this? Driving is an excellent time to do that because you can, there's plenty of stimulus involved. And if you can just pause and give yourself permission to allow your jaw to be free, just the slightest, not a hectoring type of instruction to yourself, but just a wish, the mere thought of an idea. Wouldn't it be nice if my jaw muscles weren't tense? And you'll see some amazing effects, especially on how you hold your head. I was going to get back to misconceptions about how the lower jaw works. Way that people think that the opening and closing of the jaw works is to think that there are two movable parts. If you can think of those chattering teeth that they use, set it, wind them up, and they go up and down.
Right.
That's a particularly harmful body image for people to have, because what that does is it puts a set in your mind, when you're going to open your jaw, that you have to bring your head back and down to pull your head open. In order to move your upper jaw, what you have to do is move the back of your head, constrict it back and down. And if you're interested enough, the listeners to go ahead and have some Alexander instruction, you'll see that that is a really that's a movement that's fraught with all kinds of woe for people to make that a habitual movement, particularly when you think how many times you open and close your mouth during the day. If you have that idea of how your jaw opens and closes, then looking at that anatomy book will do you a lot of good. You can let that idea go right away. That's wrong, and that's harmful.
Absolutely. And I want to get I want to talk a little bit about some of the broader implications of looking after that part of your body. But before we do that, I would think a lot of people listening to this would ask, how about various devices that dentists will prescribe for TMJ? Is that helpful? How does that fit in with what you've just been saying?
Well, you know, typically dentists will prescribe mouth guards. Something you can buy them in the drugstore, you know, those mouth guards, when you close up into them, most people that have temporal mandibular dysfunction have an eccentric chewing pattern. There's some tightness or holding that makes their jaw close in a way that causes this pain. And what you're doing when you bite into these boil and bite mouth appliances is you're just replicating the dysfunction. And it feels better for a little while, because your jaw is opened, which brings a little bit of relief. But most people, it's a very common finding, if you're even mouthpieces that dentists will make for you that aren't done according to how the jaw actually moves, patients will wind up in the morning and say, "Where's my mouth guard?" And they find that in the middle of the night they've taken it out and flung it across the room. And a lot of times people will find a place to clench on the mouth guard itself and will wear holes through it. And so in the short run it does a little bit of good, but in the long run it can really be harmful. What I would recommend is seeking a neuromuscularly trained dentist, and have him track the movements of your jaw so you're operating. So this mouth guard is made at the physiologic rest position, which we discussed earlier. Mm-hmm. And this has some I'd like to tell you a little story about how this there's a type of, or they're called orthotics, intraoral orthotics, a mouth guard that's made in this fashion. They're actually a positioner. And there's a dentist in Halifax, Nova Scotia, who had complete neuromuscular training, and he has the computer to track the mandible. And he had a lobster fisherman come into his office. And this lobster fisherman had terrible headaches, and the dentist made him an orthotic that allowed his muscles to come into equilibrium. And he had him back a week later and to see how he's doing, and the guy said, "Listen, my headache's gone, but more amazingly is I was out on my boat and all of a sudden I could pull up the pots and fling and toss them and lift them in a way that I haven't been able to do for 20 years. And the dentist was thinking, well why did this happen? And his answer, happily, is that by balancing out the musculature that's in the head and neck, it allowed the head to come to equilibrium atop what's called the atlanto-occipital joint. The temporal mandibular joint and the atlanto-occipital joint are in the same neighborhood, and they're actually opposite ends of the same rubber band. Well, this dentist went ahead and developed what's called the Pure Performance mouth guard, and lately athletes, it's taken off like crazy, because athletes are finding when they're in the physiologic rest position, they have increased balance, they have increased flexibility, they have increased endurance. Their airways are open. And the New Orleans Saints, who just won the Super Bowl, every one of their players had neuromuscularly prescribed positioners in place. And it just has tremendous overall benefit to not have these unwanted and unnecessary muscular holdings. So I would, if somebody does have something that's not responding to self-instruction, I would give them two pieces of advice. One would be to seek out an Alexander teacher, and another would be to seek out a neuromuscularly trained dentist.
So the idea there is that if working on your own isn't helping the situation, not to go and just get any kind of a mouth guard, but get one that's specifically calibrated for you in the way that we've talked about.
Right. We don't want to perpetuate the misuse, which a lot of mouth guards which are made do that. You want to get to the reason why you're having this pain and re-educate yourself about how to let loose of habitual holdings. And the mouth guard that's made according to your physiologic rest position will remind you of how it feels to have your jaw at rest and in equilibrium.
I would think also that if you, the listener, do a little experimenting of the kind that you've encouraged them to do, and they get some results, but maybe not. The pain doesn't totally go away. I would think that that's a pretty good indication that they might do well to, as a first step, find an Alexander technique teacher to help them refine those experiments. Because one thing an Alexander technique teacher would bring to the equation is they're right there, they can observe you, and they can use their hands to very gently guide your jaw and your head in a way that maybe you would have a little bit of trouble on your own doing.
Exactly.
So, probably, and there would be all kinds of other benefits too if you saw a teacher, because teachers really work with your whole body, and there may well be other issues that a teacher would address, of which the TMJ problem might be kind of almost an early warning sign.
Exactly.
Of bigger things.
We see all the time that everything is connected, but that if you're holding in one part of your body, the TMJ is an unusual and important joint, but it other joints in your body have the same rules that apply, that if a joint is open, it operates more efficiently and with more ease. And that goes for your hip joints, your knee joints, your ankle joints. And one other fact that is wonderful is that ease can spread throughout the body. That if you gain ease in one part of your body, it can spread by not addition, but by subtraction.
Right. Yes. And it's interesting that the location of the TMJ joint, as you've described it, is awfully close to the location of the point where your head moves on top of your spine.
Yes, and it's well known that form follows function. If you were to take a close-up photograph of the head of the condyle of the lower jaw, that ball that sits on top of the vertical part of your jaw. The jaw is shaped like an L, and there's the top of the ball. It's called the condylar head. If you would take a close-up picture of that, and then you would take a skull and turn it over, and there's also a condylar head at the base of the skull that sits in a concavity at the top vertebra, and you take a close-up picture of that condyle, and you put those two photographs side by side, you would be hard pressed to tell the difference between what's the condylar head of the mandible and what's the condylar head of the skull. And if form follows function, you know those two joints, the atlanto-occipital joint and the temporomandibular joint, are very closely related. One influences the other just tremendously. Just one last guided experiment before we wear this out is, if the listeners would just close their jaws together and give a little clench and then turn their head to the side, just make that movement of following your eyes and looking to the side. Okay, now bring your head so it's facing forward again and give that little Boston and let your jaw have space between the teeth. And then make that same movement, most people will report a tremendous amount of increased flexibility and ease. You can't have a free jaw without a free neck, and vice versa. There's a real interplay between the atlanto-occipital joint and the temporomandibular joint.
And we should probably say here that in the Alexander technique, the head neck area, head neck upper torso region, is considered to be a kind of a primary to everything else in many ways. That is, if you're going to intervene to bring about an improvement in your functioning, it's very likely that one of the first, if not the first places to intervene is in that very area. C1, C2, the jaw, the head, the whole head, neck, upper body relationship. So this ties in very much with basic Alexander technique ideas about the importance of
one of the pioneers who gave scientific verification to the Alexander technique was Frank Pierce Jones, and he described the atlanto-occipital joint, where the skull rests atop the spine, as the prime distribution point for bodily stress. That if you can intervene at that point to introduce ease, to allow to let go of muscular contraction in that area, then a net. If that area is constricted, then he likened it to a net of pulling all the rest of your body joints inward and tighter. And when you can intervene and allow freedom at that particular joint, then the net is loosened on the rest of your body. I liked that analogy. It really resonated with me.
Yeah, and we should just say here that Frank Pierce Jones was a professor at Tufts University in near Boston, and wrote an early Alexander Technique classic book called Freedom to Change. It may have a different title now. I think it's been reissued, but it's a wonderful book because he was really a pioneer in performing scientific experiments to verify the basic ideas of the Alexander technique. So,
and if somebody wanted to do some reading about Alexander technique, he also is very accessible author, in spite of being a scientist. Sometimes scientific writing is incredibly dense, but he is a classically trained liberal arts PhD as well. And he describes his first Alexander lessons. And it's hard to put into words because Alexander technique lessons are basically experiential, and it's hard to describe kinesthetic movement in words. But he does as good a job as I've ever heard. And so I, if anybody was interested in the technique, that would be a good place to start.
Yes, it's a wonderful book. It was sort of the very first of the modern set of books on the technique. I think it was written in the mid-70s, And of course, since then, there have been dozens and dozens of books, some of them very good. But his is definitely a classic and well worth reading by anybody. Martin, is there anything that we haven't covered in this so far that you think would be important to add?
Well, just to recap, people who are suffering from headaches or pain in their shoulders and neck and find themselves needlessly clenching, if they just take away the idea that gravity can be their friend and that if you just allow there to be a free and easy space between your teeth and that you can let go that muscular contraction, it's a skill that you gain that you can build on, but it takes practice, and to do it in a time of the day at a time and place, maybe when you're in front of the mirror brushing your teeth or your hair, just check in with your jaw, see if you're needlessly holding, and you'll be surprised how you'll be able to let some of that tension go and regain some of the ease that we all would like to have.
Well, I think that would be a great place to end our conversation. Today, my guest has been Martin Goldman, who's a dentist who's been in practice for some 30 years. And Martin has also trained to become a teacher of the Alexander Technique. Martin lives in and works, I guess, in Berkeley, California. Martin, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, it was more than my pleasure. Thank you, Robert.